キドキで壊れそうセンパーセンパー Hey! Are you ready? Now!
Are you ready?
Hey!
Are you ready?
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 Just by saying, are you ready?
I am ready.
We're making fun of course.
What?
The name of that show, OG No something.
I don't know. Prince
Uta
No.
Prince Sama.
Like, Sama. Some
one,
nonsense.
And it was subtitled 1000% Love, because that is also the name of the song they sing in it. That's not what this podcast is about.
Thankfully.
Oof, you can read about that on Shelf Life. This podcast... Starting over. This podcast is about... At Otakon, we saw the premiere of Makoto Shinkai's latest... Children Who Chase Lost Voices from Down from Deep Below, which he said in an interview later, that's a really literal take on the Japanese title, and when they actually market the film, they might change it to something a little more...
Gosh, do you think?
Coherent. Yeah.
I think the Children Who Chase Lost Voices, that's fine.
Yeah.
Also translated, I think, is the Children Who Chase Stars?
Hoshi no Kurumo, yeah. Children Who Chase Stars.
That's less good. Or the Children from Deep Below.
Ooh, that's good. But, yeah, I guess there's one. There's some kids. Anyway.
Or the Monster What Ate 79 Phantoms.
That's much better. Monsters on the Prowl.
Creatures on the Loose.
That's not the name of...
Watch Out for the Brain.
The Brain What Ate...
No, the What Goes Under the Table.
The Brain What Goes Under the Table and It's Bad.
No, the Magical Cat What Has Magical Powers, But It's Bad.
But It's Bad. What is that from?
That's... And a Life in Hell comic strip from like 20 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Son of movies. It's Matt Groening's strip before The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like 50 different monster titles. Movie titles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although the Monsters on the Loose and Creatures on the Prowl, that's from
Dime Store. That's Silver Age.
Some horror comics you found.
Horror comics.
At your friend's house. Those were literally the titles. Monsters on the Prowl.
Creatures on the Loose. It's pretty good. I'd buy it for a dime.
What are 7-year-old boys interested in reading about? Monsters.
Monsters. Prowling creatures.
Exclusively aliens.
Yeah. Brains that go under the table. And then there was one, Watch Out for the Man in the Aisle.
That just sounds like it's about a child molester.
Maybe it was. You only get the title.
Yikes.
I don't know.
That was a comic or that was Matt Groening?
That was it was like a one-panel comic.
Oh, okay.
That's what this podcast is about.
Hobos and Robots, Waiting for Adventure.
Hobos and Robots.
There's a pirate in that.
Pirates, Hobos, and Robots.
Waiting for Adventure.
Yeah.
All right. No. So, Makoto Shinkai, you might remember him from such films as Voices of a Distant Star, which is actually good, 5 centimeters per second, and
The Place Promised to Us
in our early days.
Yes.
Noah and I both really like Voices of a Distant Star because
yeah.
It's a 30-minute short, and it was his bust-out independent animation after he quit working at a video game company about two kids in a long-distance relationship, but it's because one of them has joined the Space Marines or Army or something and is traveling at the speed of light, and so she can only send messages to her Earth boyfriend like every once in a while. She texts him, but it's like years for him on Earth, but only a few minutes for her. In the stars, and we like the sci-fi part of it.
Well, I like, yes, I mean, it's yeah. good science fiction, but it's also, it's a very human story, and it's not something that I mean, there are plenty of stories about time dilation.
Yeah, like Gunbuster.
Like Gunbuster, mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking, like, science fiction stories, like...
Ones I haven't read.
The Forever War.
Yeah.
And this was the first time when I can recall actually feeling sort of, you know, character, real character drama in that notion.
Oh, instead of like dry science-y nonsense?
It's not dry science-y nonsense. There's a way that you can explore a concept without really taking into account the human element. And that's what, I mean, you can build a plot around time dilation.
Yeah.
And that's what the plot of Voices of a Distant Star is.
Yeah.
It just so happens that what he's interested in is not the science fiction aspect of it, but how the science fiction aspect of it affects the relationship of these two people.
Right. I think, so then, in his next two films, The Place Promised in Early Days also has a little bit of sci-fi going on because it's in an alternate universe. But mostly in 5 centimeters per second, there are two overarching themes that I think people get taken in by in Makoto Shinkai movies because there are people who are big fans of him. And I think one of those things is like how pretty everything looks, that he really does very photorealistic backgrounds. Like, I think he actually traced some photos and then colored them electronically in a way that is very stunning and true to life. And it looks like something. You don't see that look in other anime. So that's unique. And then I think people are suckers for teenagers in long-distance relationship stories. And the other two films are very slow. They're very emotive on that level. And it's always about, like, loves that don't work out. That girl you really loved in junior high and you never got together with her. And isn't that, like, sad? And I had no time for these sad teenagers and was not a Makoto Shinkai fan.
Yeah.
Beyond that. And the tough part is, like, in The Place Promised in Our Early Days, these kids are building, it's like in an alternate world where Russia still owns that northern island of Japan or something like that. And they're building a plane because they're going to fly there, or there's something crazy they're going to fly their homemade plane to. And, like, I'm on board for those parts, but I'm not on board for the part where it's like the girl goes into a coma or something. And
yeah, there's a lot of melodrama and kind of silly, well, some people take the sentimentality in Shinkai films very seriously. I find it hard to do that because it's laid on so thick.
Yeah, it's really heavy-handed.
But maybe that's your thing.
There was a guy on the ANN cast who called in one of their viewer specials it was his thing. And he was like, I super love the emoting, and that is what I am for.
Friends of ours also.
Who I don't know what you're talking about. Can you give their name in code?
P.S. for instance.
Oh, my. Caleb Dunaway.
So, I don't know about Caleb Dunaway. Probably.
Maybe.
Probably Caleb Dunaway. Nothing against Caleb Dunaway.
Right. We like him.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. So, but his most recent film, which we watched at Otakon because that was the big premiere in the big room, was a radical departure from the themes of his previous two films. I mean, maybe not totally radical, but the pace had utterly changed. And in The Place, The Place Promised Under Our Voices of 5 centimeters, trying to combine all of them. It had the stunning backgrounds of his other films, but the character animation looked very much like he's applying to work at Ghibli.
Yeah. What you will hear, what you have probably already heard, if you know anything about this movie, is that it is a Ghibli film that's not made by Ghibli.
Yeah. And people will probably think years from now, they'll be like, and that other Ghibli film.
Right.
Children Who Lost Voices. And we're like, no, that's different.
No, different.
Right.
But it's very clear that's what's going on.
It's heavily influenced. And in all of the, he gave a lot of interviews to a press conference at Otakon and talked to a bunch of people. And he said over and over again, he's like, oh, Castle in the Sky is like my favorite movie ever. And blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, that comes through in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't come through in, 5 centimeters per second. It comes through in this film. I don't think I watched all three parts of 5 centimeters per second. I think I watched 2 parts of it because it was like a 3-story thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember, I think that we watched all three, but it did not, that one did not leave much of an impression on me.
But this film, it's so like, there's so much action and adventure in it that there's a little too much for the movie. Like, he's really stretching to get all of the story in there, I thought. Like, I think he fits everything in, but there's more to it than fits in the film. And I think for me, that reminds me of like watching the Nausicaä movie, because there's more story in Nausicaä than will fit in that film, and the film suffers a little bit because of it. Like, some parts of the plot don't quite hold together, and it's because, like, the comic wasn't done coming out yet. The film, it just, like, there's so, too much, you know, plot to really fit within that scope. Compared to, like, we also recently watched the actual new Ghibli movie, the Borrowers adaptation. It's called, like, Arete, the Borrower, or something.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, like, that's the opposite in terms of scope. Like, it is an adventure on a very small scale, because, you know, it's the Borrowers, so it's about tiny people. But they fit, all of the plot fits within the film. Like, there's more to their world, but they didn't have to struggle to keep the plot contained. You know the kind of notion I'm getting at?
Yeah, well, I understand. It's a small story, both literally and figuratively.
Right.
They probably, in the entirety of the film, don't travel more than one city block, really.
400 square feet,
let's
say.
Yeah. And there is, what, really only 5 or 6 characters?
Yeah. There's a lack of characters. Where, like, so the themes are smaller and it's like a personal thing. Whereas in The Children Who Chase Lost Voices, there are a bunch of characters. It's about, like, grieving and death, so there's like a human like the human condition kind of theme. There's a religion that's gigantic, there's civilizations that are dying off, which is, again, I think is a lot like Nausicaä. And one of the characters looked like, there's like a Nausicaä prequel comic that I don't know if Miyazaki was involved in or not. Sorry if you hear cat fights. We have our window open because it's summer, and are there even cat, anyway,
creatures on the prowl.
Yeah. One of the characters had the kind of hairstyle, like, from that. Like, I think some of the things they had, the elements in the civil, like, the lost civilization world, were very sort of Nausicaä-ish.
Yeah, well, I hesitate to talk too much about the actual plot of this film, as this is something that really...
It's because it's brand new, and they're showing it probably at New York Comic Con, which is coming up this fall.
And they will get a commercial release.
Yeah, and they'll get a commercial release. But yeah, I really don't want to spoil it, because there's so many moments of, like, great reveals they reveal one thing after another in the beginning, and if you know too much about it going in, it does kind of
your experience will be harmed. And I would say, actually, I didn't feel as though there was too much.
That it was the right amount.
It was so expansive that it's the sort of thing that, as much as you put in there, because it is an authentic world that is created, pretty, fully realized, I think. The only difficulty I had was that there is still the sentimentality that you can't get away from, and it's an affecting film without that.
They don't need to be sentimental.
Yes, it didn't need to put so much in the text necessarily.
It comes away with a much sort of healthier outlook on relationships than I think his other films do necessarily. Because the films are like, "Ooh, let's dwell on that girl you can't get over from junior high," whereas this film was like,
well, this is a film about message. This is a film about grief, and it's in some ways, I think there are a lot of parallels to be drawn between this and Up. Remember Up, the Pixar film?
Get over your dead wife.
Well, get over your dead wife. Yeah.
Wait.
Get some self-confidence, stupid. because.
But that man had an entire lifetime with the guy in Up with his wife. He wasn't ripped off, like.
Well, he wasn't
debatably
ripped off, but he had to come to that conclusion on his own.
Yeah.
And I don't know. We'll probably be frustrating for the listeners because, you know, we can't go into this film very much, and you'll thank us for it later. One thing I will say, though, is something to watch out for in this film.
Time and anachronisms?
Huh?
Anachronisms?
No, although it's very strange, because if you go in, ask yourself, what time period is this taking place in?
Yeah.
Because it's unclear. And
this is an interview, so it's deliberate.
Yeah, well, it has that feel, but then what is the effect of that decision?
Yeah, I almost wondered at some points in the film, I'm like, did something happen and it like destroyed time? And
well, that's why I say I don't feel like there's too much action to fit in the movie. There's plenty of stuff which is left undeveloped. This is something that I could see a sequel to, that I'd actually be interested in seeing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What, with characters doing, like, other stuff?
With maybe characters who were totally unrelated.
Doing things. Going places.
Things to do.
I think it doesn't suppose much to say, like, there's a civilization in it who, like, and this was related to Carl's question, Ogumaniac's question for the director after the film, where, like, there's a dying civilization in the film. I've said that a couple times. And, like, one of the elders of civilization says, like, this is it. This is the twilight of our civilization, and we should just, like, let it go. Like, let's not fight against fate. We're just going to sink into the sunset or whatever. And that is an interesting theme that has come up, I want to say in other... But you haven't read it, so it's no good. In Tezuka's Phoenix, which bounces back and forth. Phoenix is like 12 volumes long, and it's Tezuka's life work that he was working on while he was working on a bunch of other things over a 20 or 30 year time span. And the plot of the Phoenix series is like, volume 1 takes place at the beginning of human history. Volume 2 takes place at the end of the world. And then they work... Both ends of the series work back towards each other. So volume 2 is a little bit further in human history. Volume 3 is the next step in human history. And volume 4 is like more towards the end of time, but before the end of time. Do you get what I'm saying? Eventually it was going to meet in the middle in the present. But Tezuka died before he did a volume that took place in the 80s when he was dying. So... In the very second volume of Phoenix, there's a lot about, like, this is the end of everything, and this is it. Civilization's wrapping up. Everyone knows it. Whatever. And also at that point, like, humanity is just totally bored and apathetic.
Hmm.
Except for the people manning the nukes, I guess. But whatever. Anyway. We also watched another series recently about civilizations collapsing. In Sora no Woto, The Sound of the Sky, which is a post-apocalyptic series, although you'd not know that at first, but there's been some horrible war that has set technology back, where they have some super futuristic items and some things that are like, they barely have electricity anymore.
Yeah.
There's one telephone in the whole town, and hardly anyone.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's not something that you see very often in anime. It comes up more frequently, I think, in... literary sci-fi, but the notion of having sort of a technological decline or sort of a dark age period where you retain some of the technology, but you don't know how it works, and so you have to come up with strange stopgap solutions.
Right, there's no way to repair things that are from that.
Right, or it's very difficult, and you have to figure out how to. In Sora no Woto, they're trying to create complicated optics using glass blowing technology. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Well, they seem to come to some conclusion as to how they can figure it out.
Yeah, they're getting closer, but it's nearly impossible without.
But I find it very quaint, the notion that you could have a tank corps, which is what they are, or a platoon. And they have this very futuristic looking tank and no way to communicate except by bugle.
Yeah.
That's very charming to me.
It is. It's a surprising, charming show for being something that has the super moe designs.
And yeah, it certainly looks like it's going to be just more moe.
Yeah,
nonsense,
it looks like it's going to be
but
terrible.
But it's not. It's
but
really
no,
not.
It was good. Apparently a lot of people in the forums, because I reviewed it on Shelf Life recently, there were a lot of anime watchers who didn't understand at all they were like, Bugles and the Tanks, that's stupid. And they didn't really hang around to find out why that was going on. Or some people who watched it, and even if they reached the critical episode where that's there are some flashbacks and you learn that it's the end of civilization, or supposedly after the end of civilization, that's why that's going on. And there are some people that are just like, no, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. Well, a lot of people, I mean, this is a science fiction story, and it comes from the science fiction tradition. It is by way of Moe, but it is grounded in science fiction.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that background, I can see where you might be confounded.
Where I got that background was from a certain episode of Doctor Who that I did not get to mentioning in my review, but Genesis of the Daleks is the episode where they first introduced Davros, the mad scientist who invented the Daleks, and the Doctor and his companions go to Skaro, the home planet of the Daleks, at a time just before the first Dalek is about to be invented, and explain what happened on Skaro that it's come to this, inventing horrible death machines with, like, no soul who just want to exterminate everything. It turns out there are two races on Skaro fighting a war of attrition that's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and their civilization has begun to decline. So as soon as they land, they run into things like, you know, there are lasers, but there's also gas weapons and trench warfare and a submachine gun room. And the Doctor explains they're using both old and new technology because it's after this point of civilizational collapse. But, I mean, I haven't read a bunch of science fiction, so I didn't necessarily have that background, but Genesis of Daleks is a really great episode, and I watched it a bunch of times growing up, in part because the VHS episodes commercial released were very expensive to get, and we only had so many episodes that we taped off TV before they stopped airing it, so my brother and I had to just keep rewatching the episodes we had with no hopes of getting new episodes, or very seldomly obtaining new episodes. Weird thing to think about. Now, of course, all of the episodes, except for the ones that were destroyed in the 60s, yeah, well, were available.
It's very difficult or very different being a child today.
Yeah.
Where everything is available at your fingertips.
If you have enough bandwidth and enough memory to download it or stream it. But yeah, so that's how I knew about it. So I know what it was striking. But, like, it's that whole concept again with, like, civilization ended. It's over. And there are some characters who are like, let's just let it go.
Well, it's not, right. So it's not... It's not over, right? Yeah. They're not going to turn off the lights,
right?
Before they leave.
Still, a human
it's in decline.
Yeah,
it's in decline, and I think we have never really. I'm trying to think now, maybe the 1980s were not like this, but we as Americans, I have trouble remembering a time when the general belief was not that we were a nation in decline, and that you know, Western civilization in general was not in decline.
Yeah, I guess growing up during the Cold War, the going theory wasn't that civilization would decline. It would just keep getting more, you know, bombs would get bigger and bigger, and then we'd all kill each other off. And
yeah, there would be
no decline. There would just be
a sudden apocalypse and a clear winter.
That's it. And then mutants.
But after that, after the Berlin Wall fell, We sort of, and I still, I wasn't terribly politically aware. I was in sixth grade at that time. But I remember where we went from fear of nuclear apocalypse to general acceptance of sort of the notion of the end of history. We've mentioned it before on the podcast, but the Francis Fukuyama concept that, you know, capitalism is won out over all other forms of all other market models, and democracy is won out over all other governments, and it's just going to go like this in perpetuity forever. And so we just sort of came to accept that things were just going to keep going.
Mm.
Going the way they were.
We have talked about that in the podcast before?
Yeah.
Like when?
Well, I think at least three separate times have I mentioned Fukuyama.
I don't remember anything I say.
I don't know.
All right.
You look back through the annals of history, it's very interesting because the Roman Empire, at the apex of the Roman Empire, we're talking, I guess this was really when it became, when it stopped being a republic and started being an empire. This was during Caesar Augustus.
So we're talking Grandpa Rome.
We're talking Grandpa Rome from Italia. Everyone is writing about how Rome is finished, and in a few years there's going to be nothing left. Very negative. Everyone was very negative.
Pessimistic.
And when you reach end of Rome, no, Rome continues for another, 400 some odd years.
So.
And when you reach the end of Rome, after, it's already moved to Constantinople and the Byzantine part is still going fine. It's sort of split off, doing its own thing. And then back in Rome, they're all talking about how glorious Rome is.
Oh.
And it's all a paean to how wonderful their civilization is. And that's when they're actually in decline.
Oh, crap.
This also sort of happens in Byzantine history as well, where they're ready to give up. It happens again and again, where they dig up all of their roads and plant gardens because they're starving and, the barbarians are at the gate. And somehow they end up revitalizing, and it all comes back. And it's weird, especially, given a lot of the rhetoric that you hear these days, where we just sort of have to accept the fact that we're going to that America that is going to be a shrinking superpower, and that China and India are going to...
That's what they even were talking about today on their radio, is it with Europe in trouble financially? Is it the decline of the Western world and then the rise of the East? But hasn't there been waves throughout history of that? When the Ottoman Empire was big, that was a huge civilization.
Yep.
Just because I didn't study it in school doesn't mean it wasn't awesome for the civilized people living in it, inventing math or whatever.
Well, the Ottoman Empire was more recent.
Right. Well,
all right, never mind.
Okay.
We're going to leave that. The Ottoman Empire, of course, wasn't awesome for
the people it was oppressing.
Many second-class citizens.
Sure, but compared to the simultaneous European civilization, how was it?
I've
got the wrong era.
Unless I was the Pasha.
Okay, I've got the wrong era completely. What was the time when the Crusades were going on, but it was awesome in
Spain.
Turkey or Spain?
Well, it wasn't during the Crusades. It was not terribly awesome in Turkey. It wasn't Turkey
Fair
back
enough.
Then. It was.
Was it awesome?
Asia Minor, Anatolia, because you had all these crusaders going back and forth and pillaging and so forth.
Where was it awesome?
Spain, the Umayyad Empire. It was a Muslim empire. Yes, Spain became, during that period, sort of the light of the world. Then there was a resurgence of Europeans, and they came, and El Cid showed up and beat everyone up, and,
I haven't seen that movie.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good movie. El Cid's all right.
Is it historical and informative? It's a classic, right?
No.
Oh.
No.
Classic
I wouldn't
movie?
Say that it's, yes, it's a movie. It's a book.
A classic movie?
It's a book.
Okay.
But
movies are often based on
books. Far afield from the point here, I guess, which is that Shinkai, when one of our friends asked him a question, who do you identify with?
Oh, because there are two characters. There's one character who's like, let's let civilization decline. And then the younger guy who's like, you got to fight against it. And he was like, which one do you identify with? And Shinkai was like, well, if I was younger, the other guy. But now I see the older person's point of view. So I can identify with both.
Yeah, I totally don't. How old? Shinkai is like my age, right?
He is not that old. Yes, he is literally like 2 or 3 years older than us.
Yeah, so that's depressing because, he's accomplished.
He's made several films.
Yes. But I don't understand the rhetoric of declinism. I don't get it. And I don't understand why there is a general pessimistic bias.
Because Japan is in decline, and it has been for...
Japan, right, but...
Has been for decades.
It may be the case that your civilization is in decline.
Yeah.
But I can't think of a single good reason why you shouldn't fight against the dying of the light.
Oh, because you're still young.
I think guess.
I rebroadcast the Yoshiko Tomino, the Gundam creator, Q&A on this show a little while ago. But I think there's actually something in it. I don't think I recorded the question that was actually good, where Tomino talked about how, we probably covered this on the show before as well, where, like, there's a difference between the younger characters in Gundam who want to shake things up, change the system, revolutionize the world. Sorry, we've just been watching Utena. But, and then the older characters are getting a lot of stuff out of the system, and so the older characters in the show want to keep things status quo.
Now this makes sense.
Right. Well, now I feel like I'm of a certain age where it's sort of like the status quo is, if I'm benefiting from it, I don't want to shake it up very much. Whereas when I was younger, it was sort of like, let's shake things up, bring new people in, do something different, you know?
Right. Well, this makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're an outsider, you're fighting to get in. Once you're inside, you fight to keep anyone from, you know, taking it away from you.
Right.
You know,
it's a human.
You want people to throw you a rope when you're on the bottom, but once you get to the top, you want to pull up the rope after you.
Okay,
people
that's not
are
that
jerks.
Whoa! I'm not talking about me being a jerk.
Well, I'm not talking about you in particular. I'm saying that this is, yes, it's well documented, and
that's what people do.
This is,
it's human nature.
Certainly in yeah, it's human nature.
I thought you described it as something like about beetles and another kind of bug.
No, that's beetle versus stag beetle, eternal rivals.
No, that's different.
No, what you're talking about is not the same at all. It's the beetle and hedge, I think. The beetle and hedge theory of technological advancement, which I don't think that he coined the term, but he used it in his science fiction. It's in a John Brunner novel called The Shockwave Rider. It was sort of American New Wave science fiction from the late 70s. And what he says is that in any society, technological innovation means that half of the society is beetling towards accepting it, and the other half is hedging towards preventing it, because there's a learning curve, and they're so set in their ways that they have no intention of adapting. And certainly, yes, this is something that I find to be the case.
In your job, and
at
your
my
da-
job,
in
yeah,
your daily life,
yeah, in my daily life, people are reluctant to. They don't want, you know, whenever the system gets upgraded, they get very angry because then they have to relearn everything and it feels uncomfortable and so on and so forth.
I do think that, I don't know, like, it's really two-sided to put it that way, because there are I feel like people, especially my own age, are this sort of line in the middle where it's like, yes, let's upgrade and try it out. We also have enough years of experience with technology to actually, you know, be technological natives about it and not feel off-put by it. People who aren't easily intimidated by technology and who also embrace innovation. But I don't think that's normal. I don't know. I'm just grasping at straws. Well, not really. It's something I give a lot of thought to in my job, because, like, the younger students who come in, like, who are still in college, like, sure, they've, you know, they've never lived in a time without Facebook or whatever, but they're actually, like, a lot of them are pretty scared of using complicated programs. Hmm. And, like, I am too. Like, Maya intimidates the hell out of me, because it's, like, a really complicated program. But I'm, like, I've used software for such a long time that I have certain expectations when I sit down that software will teach me how to use it, that I will be able to figure it out, and I have a way to do that. Whereas for much older people who really get set in a certain number of ways and different kinds of software, then something like totally redesigning the Microsoft Word button bar is just a devastating blow to your workload. Which actually I also identify with that. Where I'm like, don't move all the menus in Microsoft Word. It makes my job
right,
because
it's stressful, because you got to find everything again. I don't put too much stock in the beetle and
hedge
theory, although it was instrumental to that book, which in a way was kind of before its time, because it, now that I think about it, that story is about a world where there is essentially an internet, and this would be like 1976, 77 when it was written. There's an internet, everyone is connected, and you kind of can't get away from what we would now call social media. So that you can't really have any privacy or time to yourself, because there's always, you're expected to be engaged in this network, and people have nervous breakdowns, essentially. Technological overload.
What's this book called?
It's called The Shockwave Rider.
Sweet.
Anyway, I haven't thought about that that book in a while.
Do you ride shockwaves at some point?
Getting back to, well, yeah, he's kind of like a proto-cyberpunk character.
Mm.
He's kind of a netrunner.
Surfing the net.
Yeah, a cyber hacker, a cyber cowboy, as Gibson called them.
Yeah.
It's still very analog feeling. Mm. The prose is very analog feeling. It does imagine the computer network as a place that you can go.
Oh.
Like we have this notion of the net, which was really crystallized by Gibson.
Mm.
But this predates that, and it's similar, although you really do get the feeling like this is more like one of those giant computers that's the size of
the
building.
It's one internet, and everyone has to log into it.
Yeah, it's very clunky. Okay, but to bring this back around, all right, John Brunner, he's not really known for The Shockwave Rider. Mm. He's known for another book called Stand on Zanzibar.
Mm.
It's also written in the late 70s, and it is
about... It sounds like it would have a totally sweet cover.
Yeah, it's all right, but they're all kind of all right from that time period.
Yeah.
Or maybe I just have a soft spot for them, because it's Nazca Shi.
Yeah.
But it's about overpopulation.
Yeah.
And this was the topic, the population bomb.
Yeah, wasn't there like...
In the late 70s.
I think Keith has a super sweet poster for one that's like population growth zero or something.
Yeah.
It looks like a sweet 70s film. What?
Right. And this, it's the same time that you got Soylent Green, which was an adaptation of a Harry Harrison book called Make Room, Make Room.
I guess they didn't realize in the 70s that like first world countries start to have negative population growth.
Right. Well, you say didn't realize, but how could they realize?
They didn't know. Have the numbers yet.
They didn't know.
It hadn't happened yet.
And that's why I...
Because I'm telling you, like, the Swiss and the Finnish people, they'll eat us alive with their overpopulation. No,
it doesn't happen.
They have one child, and then that child kills himself.
And Harry Harrison, in Make Room, Make Room, it's a screed against Catholics, basically, where...
For more about Catholics and the birth control problem,
right.
Watch... The Meaning of Life by the Monty Python's Meaning of
Every
Life.
Every sperm is sacred.
Every sperm is important.
But what happened was the opposite. And that's why it's very difficult for me to take seriously any of the declinists, because in the 70s we were facing global overpopulation and mass starvation.
Yeah.
And now we're facing global depopulation and...
Well, not... There's enough Chinese people.
You go back to, well, no.
No, because they're all men.
That they're all men.
Crap. We're screwed.
We're screwed. No. Oh, God. No. And it's another reason why I have a hard time taking seriously any of the hype about any world-ending problem that might be on the horizon now. Because you always hear in these studies, they'll be like, if this trend continues, look at this trend over the next 50 years.
Lisa's
like,
teeth at age 16, at age 18, at like, age 19. Yeah, no.
Let's not be crazy here, people. Like, we have a hard enough time predicting what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, let alone if these trends continue.
Or the weather.
Or indeed the weather.
For the next couple of minutes. But
So... I have a hard time. I have a very hard time putting myself in the shoes of these people who wish to accept the end of their society. I think that it is it's wish fulfillment for like white liberal guilt, frankly. I don't know what that would translate into in Japan, but. I feel like it's like saying, oh, we've done such a horrible job. We've screwed up so terribly that why can't we just go off into the go west with the elves, you know.
Oh, right, into the Grey Havens. That's more of like, I don't think it's in the film that we're talking about. I got the impression it's like, it's not necessarily that they screwed up so badly. Well, I don't know. I think that isn't there more of a notion of like cyclical time in Buddhism?
Yes, certainly.
In Buddhism, and sort of like death and rebirth is mm-hmm. part of the cycle. So if they also think about death and rebirth as a societal thing, just like civilizations, they rise, they fall, they come, they go, they die. It's not necessarily like, we blew it, and this is the end of everything, like in the West. It's just sort of like, we had a civilization, and now it died. Like,
yeah, it's easy to say that, but in Chinese history, I can't think of anyone who didn't fight to maintain the mandate of heaven.
Oh.
So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe someone could, I don't know, point me to a text where the emperor's advisors are like, hey, man, it's over. Cool. Just, you know, decline.
Let it go, man.
Like Galadriel, you know? Just
going to the Grey Havens.
Going to the Grey Havens.
You got to retire sometime. You're right. But yeah, I don't know anything about Chinese history. But I think we've talked about the Mandate of Heaven on the podcast before.
Probably.
If you haven't seen 12 Kingdoms, really good show.
Mm-hmm.
The book may be less of a coherent point. We also watched another show recently that had... It was another Chinese adventure.
Hero Tales.
It kind of kept our attention.
Yeah, better than mediocre.
It's definitely rentable.
I would not have watched it if it wasn't assigned.
Yeah, I wouldn't have either.
A&M.
But the Fullmetal Alchemist character designer did it, but not working very hard. And I think it was co-production with China. And so, like, but there's that theme that comes back to it. It's also in 12 Kingdoms, is really heavily in Hero Tales, where the emperor's chosen by God to be emperor, fated to be emperor, but he can only keep the will of the mandate of heaven if they're a good emperor. And if they suck at being an emperor and get really corrupt, then they also lose the will of heaven. And when that happens, or the mandate of heaven, you get your famines, crops die, earthquakes,
floods,
people die off, bad things happen.
Wars.
And that's, I guess, it's something that happens a lot in Chinese sort of stories.
Yeah.
Where they're like, bad emperor, bad times.
Natural
phenomenon fucks you over. And actually, like, in that, what was it, 2 years ago or last year, there was a really bad earthquake in China. 2 years ago. Remember? Really horrible. 9 point whatever. Where, like, they did a study later in the aftermath. It was the earthquake where all the schools collapsed.
Oh, sure, yes.
And killed children.
So we're talking now 4 years ago.
Right. So 4 years ago. So China's a big place. A lot of different local government branches with varying levels of corruption. So when they did they went into the towns that the earthquake affected on whatever mountain, and they found it varied from town to town, the level of destruction, because in towns with totally corrupt government officials, the schools were not built to code, they collapsed on the children inside. Counties that had a really great local government with not much corruption, everything was built to the earthquake code, and the towns were barely damaged.
Yeah, well...
And so I think that's an example of the mandate of heaven, like, that kind of myth coming literally real in real life. Like, bad politicians caused bad things to happen for their people.
Okay.
Like, you can mismanage land in a way that will cause droughts, floods, and fires.
Riddle me this, Batman.
Like, the Tennessee Valley Commission do you know what I'm talking about? One of the things that caused the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression was mismanagement of the Tennessee Valley, the rivers that go through Tennessee Valley in America. And I assumed it was a technological problem that they didn't know enough about water tables and surveying to manage the water correctly in the agricultural centers.
You know, one of our friends just read a book on the Dust Bowl.
Yes.
And he gave me like a 45-minute lecture on it. It was really interesting, and I retained about three words.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it is pretty complicated stuff. I assumed that their technology level wasn't adequate enough to manage the farms on it. But it could have also been like a state government problem or like just the lack of land management. But now I think after that kind of disaster, the United States puts a lot of money towards like making sure that kind of thing is managed in a way that's not disastrous.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm sure that's true.
Right. But I'm just saying it's important because you can... something that seems like a horrible natural tragedy, Like, even, well, in the face of horrible natural tragedies, a good government helps out the people.
Yeah, that is something that
a government that
typically falls under the responsibilities of a government.
Right, where it has nothing to do with the emperor being chosen by God or fate or whatever. It's just, were your politicians collecting bribes and whatever, like.
Right.
Sort of, yeah.
However, the mandate of heaven works. It works in the opposite, right? It's the divine right of kings.
Okay.
It works to anoint someone, not by, you know, democratic choice, but by puissant force of arms, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Once you have subdued the people, and you're running things efficiently, it's assumed you've got the mandate of heaven.
Yeah.
I'm not big on, you know, divine right of kings. And also, if anyone has the divine right to rule in China, it's not the Communist Party, and they've been in control, 52 years now?
Here's my joke. I didn't vote for them.
Yeah, well, I didn't vote for them either. And those poor parents who lost their kids in those school collapses,
yeah,
were given the option to, they could either take money and shut up or complain and go to prison. So,
yep.
Most of them took the money.
But, in Hero Tales, there is a succession to the throne where that one, the protagonist is born to, he's supposed to be, you know.
Yes, he's supposed to seize the sword that indicates that he has the divine right to rule.
Right, because he was born to do it. But then there's like that general who decides he's powerful enough that he's going to take the throne
and
also retroactively get the divine right somehow.
Yep.
I had a little hard time following their mythology.
That's what it is.
Where he's
that's
like, no, really, even though you have succession rights, it's me because I happen to have a really powerful army. La la la. I was trying to tie this into Game of Thrones at some point.
I don't know why.
Because you get a significant army, and they have really, you know, really specific succession rules that they're strictly following. But it's also military might.
The rules of succession are: you kill the guy, then.
Well, they say they have rules about who can inherit the throne, and that's why they're vying for that. That's why they're hiding the son's illegitimate heir, like the king's illegitimate heir and stuff, because it's like.
Yes.
He has a claim to the throne.
Right. Yes, he's got a claim to the throne. And this is how dynastic struggles happen. Right.
But not with the horse people in that. That's whoever is the strongest fighter.
Yeah, whoever.
Don't care about succession at all.
Kills the dude.
Yeah. Who's ever the strongest. Anyway.
Silly. Mongols.
What?
The Mongols.
The Mongols?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're supposed to be steppes people.
We have more to say about Makoto Shinkai? Or maybe Sora no Woto?
Well, I haven't said what I wanted to say, which is pay attention to eyes over the course of the film, because I only started to notice that there was an eye motif.
Oh, at the end.
About,
yeah.
3/4 of the way through. Some people, they have one eye covered in shadow.
Yeah.
Pay attention to who those characters are.
Oh, it's important.
And see what's going on there.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that going in. I would have been paying closer attention to it.
His other films, except for maybe Voices of a Distant Star, are not something that I'd watch twice, but this one is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd watch it again.
Yeah.
Although we keep comparing it to Ghibli, there are a lot of the monsters and god characters like have more of a Hideki Anno thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they open their mouth and it's like one of the angels from one of the movies.
Yes.
Yeah. A couple times. And especially the scenes at the very end.
But
looks like that. But what?
But no spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers.
No spoilers. Because it's not a spoiler to say that the monsters, I think,
look like Hideki Anno. Yeah.
Well, no. The monsters are like really part of the best part of this film.
Yeah,
there's
some great monsters.
There's some really great monsters.
And there were not monsters in his other films.
And I am tough to please with monsters. These monsters.
No, is a monster
right.
Connoisseur.
I'm a monster.
That's how we've tied it back to Monsters
Maven.
On the Prowl. A monster maven.
Yeah.
He was reading the monster manual just moments before we recorded this.
That's
sort of true.
Not literally true, although there is the Fiend Folio is about two feet away from me.
Is that not a monster manual of some sort?
It is later incorporated into the Monster's Compendium, but that's not really important.
Oh, it might be for our listeners.
If it's important for our listeners, they probably already know it.
Nerds.
In any event, see the new Shinkai film, see The Borrowers. They're both really worth your time.
You can import The Borrowers movie. Ghibli always puts English subtitles on their films. It's a non-Miyazaki Ghibli film. They picked another young director to try it out, to try his hand at directing. So it has a little bit of a different feel than if it were a Miyazaki movie. I think it's good. I think The Borrowers was really good for a first film, especially.
Oh, certainly.
It's really spectacular.
For a first feature.
Yeah.
It's a very strong film.
Yeah.
It doesn't achieve that Totoro level of resonance, but it's emotionally affecting.
Yeah, it's a solid movie. I think little kids would be bored by it, but.
Yeah.
But sophisticated kids or older kids or the audience of the New York Children's Film Festival, who are all very erudite film watchers, asking great questions after S'mores. It's basically candy for them because they're thinking about it because they're going to.
Now I regret. I hate staying for the Q&A for anything ever.
Yeah.
Because the questions always make me feel embarrassed for being a fan.
Noah left halfway through the Makoto Shinkai Q&A after this film, but we had several friends in line, so I kind of stuck around. Some of the questions were kind of dumb, but I wanted to hear what Mike Toole was going to ask, and he was at the back of the line. I also had a good time taking pictures of people who we knew asking Makoto Shinkai questions, so I could be like, here's your photo with Makoto Shinkai, it's you and Makoto Shinkai.
I guess.
I was driven by...
I guess that's cool.
Because I like the film so much. I wasn't a Makoto Shinkai fan before that, but now I'm like, oh boy, I can't wait to see what he does next. Actually, this kind of leads this. I want to leave this podcast with a bunch of hope for future of anime based on future film directors, the guy who directed Summer Wars. I'm looking forward to whatever he makes next. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to where Makoto Shinkai's career is going after this, since it's taken such a radical turn. I'm looking forward to the guy who directed The Borrowers going on, do stuff, having a good career. I've heard a lot of complaints on other shows where it's sort of nobody's being trained to be an animation director. And it's true, because when you farm a bunch of stuff overseas, directors can't learn the kinds of things they need to learn to be able to direct films. So it's a little bit harder to have another generation of creators. And also being an auteur in Japan is hard to do.
Yeah.
Just the way they're set up.
Yeah.
But I think if they keep producing really great, feature films for, a world market, sort of Soshikan style, then there is another generation on the rise of anime directors for now.
Yeah.
They're in their 30s.
I think so. I think that there'll be plenty of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Glad to see it.
Did you have something else to say about... Oh, Q&A sessions. Oh, right. Because at the New York Children's Film Festival,
I was I've got to get out of here before these kids drive me crazy. But it turns out...
It was a children's film festival showing of Summer Wars, and... So the audience was filled with children, and one section that was just people our age who knew about...
Right.
Who keep following the festival because it occasionally shows anime. So there were all of us from New York who were, anime bloggers and podcasters and stuff. Geek Knights were there, and the Reverse Thieves, and, a bunch of our friends.
So, apparently the Q&A was awesome.
We left to go to a friend's birthday party, mostly.
That's true.
Yeah.
And of course, kids don't know any better, so many of their questions are interesting. They don't suffer from wanting to ask a question, so they will have had the experience of asking a question to whoever this important person is.
Oh.
Which is why most people ask questions at these Q&A sessions.
That's so funny. When I was a kid, they bussed me out to an event where Madeline Lingle was speaking.
Hmm.
There's long-ass Q&A session, or maybe it didn't last the amount of time it did in my head, but the point of the story is a lot of kids seem to ask a question just to ask a question, and kids kept asking, how many books have you written? Which is absurd. You could answer that in other ways, even in, 1987.
All right, so kids are also stupid.
Right.
What do kids know anyway?
This was a specific audience of children who have been going to these, International Children's Film Festival movies. The film festival has quite a following. They're New York City kids whose parents are probably pushing them to go into, really high-fluting schools and to be very, like, film-educated.
Yeah.
Because they live in New York City. They have an opportunity to see, like, all kinds of films on the big screen and whatever that, like, maybe if you lived in a more rural area, your parents would not take you out to the theater on a Sunday to see Swedish children's films.
And chances are there is nothing that a creator is going to tell me in front of a room full of people that I am going to have any interest in knowing.
Mm.
If I was having dinner with the guy or whoever, and we were having a conversation,
right,
and it was, you know, back and forth, and we could get into topics, and, you know, we could go off on tangents and so forth, that makes sense. The sorts of questions that I might want answered would not be questions that would be answered honestly in front of a room full of people, you know?
Right.
So, anyway, we suffered for it because...
Apparently the questions were all great.
Yeah, the questions were great. It's the Summer Wars Q&A, and... Oops. Oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, I understand your point of view on Q&A, and it can often be extremely painful, but sometimes, like, once in a while you get a really great Q&A session, or even during a bad Q&A session, sometimes, like, 10% or 5% of the content will have been worth staying there for an hour, like, unless there was some competing event to go to.
Right, well, that's...
But yeah, it's the signal-to-noise ratio.
It's a signal-to-noise ratio that is not sufficient to keep me in my chair.
That and, like, the 10% of the most painful questions are so painful that you wish you would just, like, die in your seat and, rather than know that person exists.
Yeah, which is why I leave.
Yeah, to avoid that feeling. All right. That wraps up our children who something voices...
And let that be a lesson to you. Don't ask stupid questions.
Just
don't ask questions.
Have a really good one.
Just, if only we could get to a point where instead of Q&A, these people could just deliver a 45-minute lecture on a topic of interest to them.
Yeah.
I think that would be so terrific. We, like, have these people there.
Like TED Talks?
You know, like TED Talks. It, on anything.
Have to be on the film you just made.
It doesn't have to be on the film you just made. What do you think about? What do you find interesting?
The history of cheese.
And it does make a difference because this is the person who made whatever that thing is. And if you're interested in that thing, you must be interested in the thought that went into it and the thinker behind it.
Maybe. Not everyone is.
No, I guess not. But they should be.
They should be.
Very special secret. I'm the only one who knows about tiny people living in our walls called the Little.